Hey, everybody. Before we get to today's podcast, Brandon and I want to tell you about something exciting that maybe you've heard of, maybe you haven't. It's a new project that we've launched that we're offering to you called Intensive Care Academy.
Yes, ICA is now live. It is a web-based, video-based teaching platform. Many ways similar to this podcast, but it is videos, it is a little more structured and more rigorous and more comprehensive, and it's just another way for us to teach critical care. So if you're interested in this, we think you might be interested in that. Currently, what you'll find there is the Foundations program, which is over 50 lessons intended to orient somebody new to critical care, kind of targeted at the new critical care APP, like a NP or a PA starting critical care with no prior training, kind of going through everything from A to Z, from diseases to treatments to diagnosis to procedures. And we're going to continue to have new content all the time for different folks. You'll also get access to two new private podcast feeds, one with audio versions of the lessons to review, and ICA Pearls, which is the new home for the Turbos, which are leaving the free podcast here. Also, live Q&A sessions with us and a lot more. If that interests you, and we're hoping it will, go check it out, ICU101.com. It's ICU101. And let us know what you think.
Now, on with the podcast.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. It is Brandon Odo, back with Brian Bowling here.
Hey, everyone.
And we got a lightning rounds for you today, discussing what I can't imagine, can't help but be an interesting topic. Hopefully, we'll be able to shed a little bit of light. But the question that we wanted to dive into is AI, the role of artificial intelligence, especially in medicine. You'd have to be hiding under a rock not to recognize the incredible advances that have been made in this area just in the past couple of years. And you would have to be the world's champion at not connecting dots, not to think that it's going to have, if not already, is having an important role in the medical field. And there has been work being done in this area and continues to be done. And I think like every human being, we all wonder, you know, what does this mean for us? I mean, even as patients, but certainly as clinicians, how it might affect the work that we're doing, as of course it's probably going to affect, you know, our lives in general. But it's new to us, and it's certainly outside of the area of expertise for Brian and I, by which I mean we don't know anything about anything. But perhaps that describes a lot of you guys too. So we thought we'd bring on a proper expert, and we're here with Nara Shara, who is the chief of research data science over at MedStar Health Research Institute, as well as the co-founding director of the AI collab between MedStar and Georgetown. And she's going to help us understand this topic a little bit, at least a little bit, at least pique some interest, get us excited or scared or I don't know. Some kind of emotions may happen. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here today.
So I'm hoping that this won't be something where Brandon and I just sit here and nod along as if we understand what you're saying, but really don't have a clue. I like to think we're sophisticated guys, right? We're somewhat tech savvy. We have a podcast, right? I guess let's start off with this. I think when people hear AI, they have one of two sort of visceral reactions, I think, in that either they think it's a bunch of whatever, fine, or they think it's going to take my job, or it's going to take over the world. And I suspect that it's probably somewhere in between, right? So let's start off with this. What is AI? Because I think a lot of us just sort of say that and don't really know what we're talking about. And we probably use it every day without even knowing it, right?
So let's think of AI as a simulation of human intelligence. So in the past, we experienced multiple revolutions. The Industrial Revolution in the 18th century with the textile industry, and then the Second Industrial Revolution with the adoption of electricity, the Third Industrial Revolution with the digital innovations with computers and so forth. Let's look at this as the Fourth Industrial Revolution, where it's emerging between physical, digital, biological systems that are driven by AI, robotics, IoT, and other techs. And so AI really is an umbrella term that's used to characterize multiple tools that are out there. They're basically math. It's math on steroids. It's the merge of the computational power that we have been experiencing, big data, computing and cloud infrastructure all coming together, making things happen finally. And so it's the simulation of human intelligence in machines that are programmed to mimic human cognition, learning, problem solving, perception, all of the above. Does that help?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think so. So, all right. So you mentioned robotics, but we're not necessarily talking about, you know, robots doing stuff. I mean, that's part of it, but it's more just the decision-making and sort of like you said, it's mimicking what the thought processes and the decision-making that I could do if I had access to all of the world's information and data. Is that fair?
Yes, correct. And the recent, developments are in the large language models that we all hear about. But there are lots of other branches, and I often try to use real-world use cases to explain what each one of those different branches can do for us. So there's NLP. You've heard of natural language processing. It's a field of artificial intelligence that focuses on the interaction between computers and human language, which enables machines to understand, interpret, and generate natural language. There are robotics, like you mentioned. There's machine vision. Where it involves the use of computer vision technologies to enable machines to capture, process, and analyze visual information. There's machine learning, whether it's supervised, unsupervised. Each one of those has its own applications. And oftentimes, you don't really have to, you know, use the most complicated. The solution can be using one simple method from this big umbrella that we refer to as AI. And I'm happy to provide a real use case. For example, as patients come through a healthcare organization, they can provide in their own language their experience and can describe what did they find as the most positive versus the most negative. You can apply natural language processing to take their words, come up with themes and concepts that can characterize their preferences, whether they were, they found wait time, or they found lack of empathy, or they found out that hygiene was the top, concern that they had throughout their journey. And these tools come very handy and can be used real time to synthesize the information and give you, measurable or measures that you can act upon.
Basically, it's a way of taking feedback from patients, in your example, with a way of taking feedback from patients and turning around into ways that we can improve things sort of in real time, rather than waiting for, you know, feedback from surveys and aggregate data and stuff later on.
Exactly. Other use cases that are happening right now as we speak, and maybe in some of the healthcare organizations, not everywhere, and in others are being tested to see the, in the recent years, you have heard certainly about clinicians' burnout and about patients' lack of trust and dissatisfaction and all of that. And part of that goes to the current environment that our frontline healthcare workers live in, which is reporting. We are required to report every single interaction with our patients so that we can gather as much information as we can so that we can make educated, evidence-based decisions. And so if you've gone to the doctor in the recent years, you have noticed that the doctors are constantly typing into a computer. They're looking into the screen, they're typing, they're trying to capture that experience. There has been a breakthrough in the last couple of years where there is what we call an ambient scribe. An ambient scribe is a tool that sits in the room that captures the information through their natural language. It's the conversation. It's captured. It goes through natural language processing. The pertinent information that needs to go into the EHR, the electronic health records, gets transferred that way. Other information that is irrelevant gets scrapped. And so these intelligent tools are actually used to eliminate the burden off of the shoulder of the frontline healthcare workers, the clinicians, whose time is so precious, and the patient appreciate spending time with the doctor or their clinician rather than looking at a computer or watching their doctor talk to a computer than themselves. So I think in the next few years, we will see a huge uptake of these types of technologies because it really enables the clinicians to spend more time with their patients, and it improves patient satisfaction and patients' overall outcomes.
It seems like you could, the potential use cases for this are obviously vast. I'm sure we're figuring them out. But just intuitively, it seems like you could probably divide a lot of them into either replacing or augmenting roles that clinicians don't really want to do versus replacing things they do want to do, which is probably not as desirable, although it might be desirable to somebody, for example, to save money.
It's exactly what you said. It's taking the machine off of the clinical team. It's removing the redundancies, removing the tedious, removing the complicated stuff that often takes away of the precious time that we can spend taking care of our patients and enabling our clinicians to do what they like to do best, which is patient care. And so absolutely, in the last decade or so, we have seen huge burden and burnout in our frontline healthcare worker altogether, from the nurses to the doctors to the social workers to the physical therapist. Everybody is burdened by the amount of reporting, by the amount of things that they have to do that's outside of what they went to school for. And so we are now bringing the machine. And that was created because the technology enabled more reporting and enabled us to act on more data. And more data means more work on our end as humans. And so now we're bringing the machine back and the intelligence of the machines to remove that aspect of the job that actually is burdensome for us. So we're treating the disease that we created with the technology with another technology.
Well, and of course, I'm sure it could be a double-edged sword, right? Because one person's unwanted busy work is another person's the entirety of their job, right? So mm-hmm. Some of us may discover that if a machine is doing a lot of writing our notes or something, we don't need to be here for our entire shift. And maybe then they don't need us at all.
We felt the same way when computers were a thing. So a couple decades ago, people were scared that they're going to lose their jobs. But what did we do? We created even more jobs and more jobs. And so I think there are jobs that are going to be gone. There's no question that AI will actually take over few of the jobs or many of the jobs that are there. But there is an anticipation and prediction that AI will create in the millions of new types of jobs that require new skill sets that we hope that we can train the next generation of the workforce to be able to handle.
I guess the difference that I think of, and I agree with you, I'm by no means a Luddite who wants to put a damper on technology and stuff, but I think the difference is you mentioned, well, and not just computers, right? You can go all the way back to the first industrial revolution, right? Now we have a shuttle loom that's going to require less work from a weaver, right? And we're going to lose jobs. But I think the difference, at least from what I think as someone who's not an expert on this, and probably what a lot of other lay people would think in terms of AI, is this is not just a tool that can do the job of like manual labor or tedious things, but it's a tool that can learn and do more complicated, bigger jobs. And so, I think that's sort of what we say at every revolution, right? Is we go, well, yeah, it's going to put some people out of work. It's going to take the job, but it's going to take menial jobs. So just train yourself better to be a job that requires more thinking and less, you know, manual labor or automatous work, and it'll be fine. But now we're talking about machines that can actually learn and grow and become better, right?
Correct.
Right. Is there any subset of skilled labor that is safe from that, at least eventually?
So I would look at it this way. I think the current developments in AI can take three different shapes: assistive, augmentative, and autonomous. And for the exception of, you know, very, very few things that are out there, including maybe retinal imaging or something, there's nothing autonomous as of yet. We have a lot of assistive, which improves, you know, our productivity, improves efficiency, improves early detection, improves, and it's always has human in the loop, which means the clinicians, the care team is always in the loop. And we have augmentative, which detects and can, you know, generate results and so forth, and also has the human in the loop. And so think of a radiologist who used to make a decision independently on all the images that it comes through. Now, what you have an AI tool that exceeds the accuracy of humans, of many radiologists altogether. And you have, results coming from an AI tool in systems such as, you know, maybe our system and others. And now you have the radiologist be a deal breaker and can have a say in addition to the information and the knowledge that he or she is being given to make a final decision. And so we're keeping the human in the loop. And I anticipate that's going to continue to be the same way. But now we have a situation where, you know, you might not be 100% sure, but you have a tool that's been trained on millions, if not billions, of images that's giving you more information that you can act upon in a much more efficient way and much more accurate way. And so we may not need 50 radiologists in a hospital, but we will still need radiologists to be involved in making a decision at the end of the day. Having said that, we all speak about, you know, a lack of empathy. I told you in one of the studies that I've done, we applied natural language processing and we found out that patients' number one complaint in healthcare is lack of empathy. The doctor didn't look at me in the eye. The doctor didn't spend enough time with me talking about my condition. And so what if we bring AI to take away the machine from our frontline healthcare workers and provide them the time and the ability to spend more time with our patients? And so I feel like we are worried that it will take away some jobs, but I think what is going to happen, a doctor with an AI knowledge will be much more competitive than a doctor without an AI knowledge, but it can be generalized to everybody else across the healthcare spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, you walk into a hospital ward these days and you look at what everyone's doing, and by and large, they're sitting on a computer, you know, typing or something, which is all, what we're all used to, but it's perhaps not what everyone's ideal vision of what modern medicine would be. But, you know, it seems like the other way you could divide this is in the kind of activities that AI can assist with, and its output is transparent and understandable, and so that we can understand how it arrived at that and can perhaps troubleshoot it if need be. Like you talked about generating documentation, which is, you know, it sounds like an evolved version of the dictation we do now. You can dictate, and then you can see what it dictated and see if it's correct or if you agree or fix it. Or if your, you know, your radiology support tool describes something, you can check yourself. But I could imagine at a certain point, you have tools that are reaching conclusions or decisions where it's just a pure black box and you don't understand them. And at least the way the world is now, that seems like it could be treacherous. I mean, Brian and I both generally are advocates for understanding all the processes you're working with as much as possible, because even if you're not directly responsible for them, if you set something in motion, ideally you understand all the nuts and bolts that go into it, because that contributes to the logistics of how it gets done and the ability to troubleshoot if anything goes wrong. Whereas if, you know, we get to a point where it's like, you know, evaluate patient for cholecystitis and treat it, and you press that button, but you don't really know what happens after that, then it could be that that process is better than our own process, more reliable or safer. But if it does go wrong, we don't know how to intervene on that because we don't know what happened or how it got to where it did. You know, I just bought a car, so this is directly on my mind. But I've heard it said that, you know, a lot of the cars being made now are so high tech that they are more reliable and safer and more efficient than older cars. But they're also that much harder to work on because there's a lot of it's electronic and things like that. So, you know, if something breaks, you probably can't fix it in your garage, and maybe your local mechanic can't even do it. And maybe the only thing to do is just replace the entire part because it is such a advanced level of thing. And maybe that's kind of where we end up. Because I'm sure that we would try to make all of these tools as transparent as possible for as long as possible. But there is some point where you have to just give the control over to the system and trust it, or at least trust its internal processes to check itself. But then you can't check that that's working either.
Right. I mean, it's the same with humans, right? Do you ever know how the trail of thoughts and the processes that your doctor came to diagnose you? I mean, it's the same thing. What is the level or the error rate that you would be accepting from a machine vis-a-vis a real human being? I think that's the question. We are at a point in time where the adoption is very slow and it's not happening at a pace that is commensurate with the developments that are taking place out there. Because we don't have these guardrails. We don't know what data was used to train this AI. We don't know how did it come to this. It's a black box, and it's a very complicated black box that we're talking about. And so we are putting the kibosh on lots of things because we are spending time now trying to define what do we mean by trustworthy AI? What does it mean to trust an AI tool in making a decision that is going to impact your life, good, bad, ugly, however it's going to be? And so we are working on that, exactly what you described. You drive an autonomous car. Do you understand everything that goes? You just trust that it's done by the best of the best in the world. And, you know, all the technology that has been put in has been tested multiple times. Some people died in the midst, and, you know, lawsuits have been rampant in that space. Same thing. Look up lawsuits in healthcare AI. You will find lots of, you know, lawsuits that are out there, whether it is stemming from using AI and making an error or not using AI and making an error. Why did you not use AI when you have it in your hospital that could have detected my husband's or my father's sepsis before he passed or something like that? There are lawsuits that are going to be across the board, whether you use it or not. And so we are, as researchers, we're trying to create teams that are multidisciplinary, working with even lawyers to understand the accountability part of it. Who is, you know, going to be responsible in the event that something goes, you know, wrong by using an AI?
Can't sue the AI.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm emotionally, I would think that people are probably less accepting of an error made by AI than by a person. And I don't know why that would be. I guess maybe it seems like a scarier, more confusing thing, but maybe we just have to get used to it. I don't know, maybe eventually you go the other way. You'd be happier that your computer made an error because at least it was like an honest error. It wasn't anything personal, but
exactly. So yeah. I thought about this question a lot, Brandon, and I can tell you, if you like your doctor and you have that rapport for a long time, you're more likely to forgive your doctor. But if you go once and you hated his or her guts and something went wrong, you're more likely to sue them. And so it's going to be a philosophical question, and you are going to, you know, be more likely to be egregious or harsh on a machine that doesn't have a face and feelings and all of that than a human being, if you have that relationship with a human being to start with. But if you're angry at, you know, the whole healthcare enterprise, and I don't think that equation holds. To err is human, to forgive is divine, and we will have to address this in the near future of how do we handle this and who's responsible at the end of the day.
So maybe we trust computers as much as the average clinician, but less than a trustworthy one and more than an untrustworthy one.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I've been thinking of when we were talking about sort of just trusting the process and the black boxness of it all is I worry that you're going to end up with clinicians at both ends of the extremes, right? One who says, you know, I don't trust that computer. I'm smarter than it and I know what to do, right? This is me with Google Maps, basically, right? When we go places and my wife's like, just listen to Google Maps. And I'm like, I know how to get there better. Or you're going to have the person who just trusts implicitly. And they say, and I don't understand how it works, but they told me this. And knowing that what we've talked about with the limitations of what's out there currently, like you said, there's nothing that's fully autonomous. I worry that maybe there's going to be clinicians who just say, well, I don't know, but my gut says this, but the AI says this. And so I'm going to trust the AI because I don't know any better. I assume it knows better than me.
Well, I guess we are pushing very much to engage with the clinicians and the healthcare providers to develop these tools that eventually are going to be adopted by them and their patients. And there is no question that we have to work in harmony, and we have to engage and create those the multidisciplinary teams. Otherwise, adoption will be minuscule. Like you said, in the past, I've been in healthcare for two decades now. In the past, when we have developed solutions, if it wasn't a collaboration between us and the clinicians who eventually will use these solutions to help their patients, adoption will not happen. It's impossible to convince somebody that this tool will help you identify, you know, your patients early on before something wrong happens. But if you have champions and you work with them and understand the workflow and understand how it's going to impact their job and impact their kind of the dynamics in the clinic and how this is going to work when they, you know, see their patients, then they're more likely to advocate for it, push for it, and help with adoption. We're doing the same thing. Having said that, I think you are seeing what's happening right now. The big fives are developing all these large language models. So the developments are happening outside of healthcare with some, you know, healthcare professionals advocating and giving advice. But at the lower level, we are still not being part of the big picture, and we're trying to take things easy, and we're trying to put measures and guardrails, identify, you know, use cases that could potentially be addressed by these AI tools, and working towards that. So it's very slow. I've been doing AI research since 2018. And I can tell you, I mean, it's going to be decades before what we do in the lab becomes a mainstream.
Can you give us just a little bit of a lay of the land for where we're at with this? Because a lot of people, I think, have no understanding of it. Like, what are the sorts of AI-based technologies that are, like, currently being used in, you know, the medical space? What are the things that are right on the horizon that may be, you know, ready for application in the next couple of years? And what are the more distant things that are, you know, seem real but are nowhere near being available?
Yeah. So the tools, you know, at the moment, AI is being integrated into so many different facets in healthcare industry. However, it's done without any long-term planning. Very few of the organizations that are out there have strategy or have a clear path on how to adopt AI solutions in operations, research, education, and so forth, because these AI tools can be very costly. Having said that, there are lots of tools that are out there for early warning systems. You've heard about sepsis in hospitals and how you can use AI to detect sepsis and prevent it. The area where there's a lot of AI applications is imaging. So imaging and medical image analysis is probably the most ripe for AI intervention and AI applications and implementations. Clinical decision support. I myself have been part of several projects where we have developed machine learning. Most of the tools that are being implemented in healthcare are machine learning. tools, if you will. So whether it's supervised, unsupervised, mostly supervised, where you have labeled variables and you know what you need and you know where you're going. Unlike unsupervised, where you don't have labels and you let the tool tell you and find trends and patterns in some type of like big data. And so most of the tools, the clinical decision support tools that are out there are built on random forest, supervised machine learning algorithms that go through large amounts of data and tries to identify phenotypes that makes or predisposes certain patients to a certain bad outcome and tells you what these phenotypes look like. That these tools are out there that and can be used to prevent unnecessary screening or unnecessary treatment for things that may not, you know, be valid, can identify patients who may be at much higher risk and reallocate scarce resources to address these patients rather than everybody else. So these are the what we have right now. In addition to the administrative stuff, in addition to the translation that we use and so forth. But I think the most popular tools, AI powered tools that are out there are machine learning, predictive analytics, and clinical decision support tools that can be implemented easily without and can be monitored. And you can have a human in the loop where these are assistive and augmentative and not autonomous. And we can use them to empower our patients and our clinicians.
And what do you think we could be moving towards in, you know, let's say 20 years? What's the fully realized version of all of this?
So I think in the near future, we're trying to look at the low-hanging fruit. The low-hanging fruit is to look at the pain points in healthcare. Pain points are clinicians' burnout and patients' dissatisfaction. How do we make that better? Clinicians' burnout comes from so many patients, not enough time because of the reporting, because of that. So I think the ambient scribe is going to be huge. The ambient scribes, these tools that I mentioned to you that will just capture natural language between the clinician and the patient, and the patient and the clinician can just focus on one another and don't have to worry about reporting, sending medication, asking for this. Everything will be done autonomously on behalf of the clinician and the patient. I think that's where the future. I do believe that patients will have a little bit more access to their information and they will have a little more control over their data and what they want their data to be used for and when. And that will happen because of the ease by which that this new technology, the new technologies that we are observing will allow patients to see the potential of using their data to help them personally. And so in the near future, I think there's probably going to be a large language model that lives with each one of us that will be trained on our own preferences, our own health, our own patterns and trends and lifestyle and behavior that will actually use that information collectively and give us advice on how to pivot, how to do this, what should we do to prevent certain things. So digital twins, in another way, are going to be rampant, where you and I will have our own digital twin that could go through different scenarios of, oh, if we do this and we go that route or we take this medication in my digital twin, if we run that, these are the outcomes. Are you happy with it? And so you can pick and choose which direction to go based on your digital twin. I think that's the future, digital twins.
What about the doing of things? We're talking a lot about cognitive tasks, but you know, for roles like surgeons and proceduralists, I have not heard too much about a role for AI to either support or supplant some of those activities. Is this just that's a little bit farther out kind of thing, or?
Oh, not at all. I think autonomous robotic surgeries and things like that are happening. There was one in the news. I can't really give a lot of details, but there was a robotic surgery that took place between the clinician who was in one country and the patient who was in another country. And it went and passed and it was successful. And so I think that in the near future, we will be able to leverage skill sets and expertise from surgeons who exist in one place and the patient is in another place using this kind of robotic surgery. So it is something that is happening, I think, and will only get better and be deployed at a much larger scale. I am involved in a large project, I'm PI actually, of a large project that we are doing to leverage large language models to help our cancer patients manage their condition post-discharge, where they can talk to the chatbot and the chatbot will take the symptoms that are pertinent to their condition and create alerts to the providers real time that the provider can actually either make a quick decision, bring the patient to the clinic, and avert something that could potentially harm the patient in the vicinity of their comfort at their home and bring them to the clinic. So we are working with surgeons in multiple healthcare locations right now to try to see how patients in different settings, rural, urban, suburban, and so forth, perceive the tools and use the tools to help them post-discharge.
One other concern that I thought of while we were talking about this, particularly with the ambient scribe, I think that sounds great, right? I've thought about that for years. Like, if there was a way that I could just sort of, record my conversation with patients, or even dictate my exam as I'm doing it, and it would just go into the record. I don't have to remember it all and type it in. But I'm thinking, like, so in the clinic, it's one thing, right? So when you go into the exam room, there's this ambient scribe, and when I talk, it's going to be listening and stuff. But in an inpatient setting, right, it would be very helpful, I think, for in a patient's room, right? If I go in and see a patient in the ICU, I go into their room and I'm chatting with them, that's doing the same thing. And also with the nurses, right? When they go in, it would eliminate a lot of their recording burden. And same thing with, respiratory therapy, physical therapy, et cetera. But then I feel like we're setting up a situation similar to a lot of the concerns people have with things like Alexa, right? In that I have this thing that's always listening to me. And like I said, in the clinic, that's one thing, right? I'm going into a room for a purpose, but in the hospital, this is my kind of home for a little while. And I'm in here, maybe I'm talking with my family when there's no clinicians in the room. Is the thing listening to me? Is it going to, so I think... How do we handle those privacy concerns? Is this a situation where you have to say, we're going to turn it on and off?
Yeah, that's always going to be a concern. And it is one of the concerns that I had in my first study when I conducted in 2018. I was worried that people will not agree to participate in a study where I'm using actually a chatbot such as Alexa and others to capture their experience on a daily basis. You will be surprised. People out of everybody who was enrolled, maybe one or two just declined because of the reason that you just mentioned. And so if you're transparent and you tell them what you're going to use the tool for, and it is done in a trustworthy environment, our patients feel like they can trust their clinicians, you're more likely to, but the clinicians have to trust these tools first. And so we work with the clinicians to have them in the loop when we develop tools that are going to eventually be used on their patients. And if that's done right with, full transparency, how the data is going to be used, why is it going to be used for the, goodwill of everybody and so forth, I think our patients will not have that as one of the things that will prevent them from adopting some new tools that they see the value of. So I am concerned about that, but I'm not that concerned about it because I think there is an issue of malfeasance everywhere in anything we do. If you want to inflict harm, you can, whether it's, but we want to create an environment where we can trust the developers and the users alike on doing the right thing. How do we do that? everybody's scrambling right now, including large organizations like the World Health Organization, everybody to create some, white papers and some policies and measures to, not control, but to provide guardrails on the safe use of AI. And the executive order from the White House a year ago by President Biden highlighted the importance of developing tools that can prevent harm from people, from our citizens, and can actually ensure that they are safe and protected and so forth. So there are lots of things that are happening right now. Specifically, the technology has gone so far that we are just scrambling to catch up with. The development of the tools is probably one of the things that's happening. It's adoption. It's creating the landscape and how does it look like in real life when you adopt it. It's the policies. It's the accountability. These are the things that are delaying the implementation of these tools. It's not the actual technology development. That's gone much further than we can imagine right now.
I mean, I guess, like you said, it does really kind of all come down to trust. And I mean, that's true of everything. And I mean, people trust, how many people have Alexa in their house listening to their every words? And
the phones, you don't even have to have Alexa, right? Your phone. I say something and next thing I know, oh my God, blue mattress.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, my wife and I joke all the time that, oh, hey, guess what's coming up in my Facebook ads? Something I haven't searched for, but we were talking about it the other day. And we sort of just joke and play it off. And I don't think any of us would stipulate that Facebook and Alexa, or say Amazon rather, have our best interests at heart, right? They're purely trying to sell us stuff. I guess that does make sense. Then if you trust your healthcare provider.
I think so. And we're trying to restore that trust because our healthcare providers really work very, very hard to keep up with, clinical care and the requirements to report and all of that. And in the midst, that relationship got, shaky between the care team and the patients. We want to restore that because we deserve to have, optimal care in this country. We are spending so much on healthcare. Let's make it right.
I was just reflecting or trying to reflect on, as a patient, what the experience could be like in a system that was making use of a lot of these tools. And my first thought was it might contribute to the kind of Kafka-esque nature of modern medicine, where a lot of it is these obscure kind of immobile processes that you can butt your head against and not make any progress. But really, when I think about it, that seems to just come down to how good the tools are. Because the reason that it's frustrating to call my cable company and get their phone tree is because 80% of the time the phone tree can't do what I want. That's why I want to talk to a person and they can probably do that. But if the phone tree could do what I want, then I would probably, do it efficiently, then I'd probably be perfectly happy about that. And then it just starts to blend in with treating the tool like treating a person. Because of course, if I do talk to a person, they also may or may not be able to help me. They may be smart or dumb. They may have the kind of power in their system to act or not. And maybe that's what the tool itself becomes. So probably I would think that as a patient, if I interact with the healthcare system and I get shunted off to, talk to our AI assistant about that, my reaction to that, assuming I trust it, like you guys are saying, would probably come down to, is it any good?
Yeah.
If it's likely to address my problem in a satisfactory way, or more likely than if I dealt with a person, then I'd probably be perfectly happy about that. Whereas if it sucked, then it would start to feel like, they'd sent me to their phone tree and it was just one more barrier. And, maybe if it sucked in some obscure way, and either it couldn't understand me or it just couldn't do the thing I needed, like I needed to do a particular, we needed the sort of flexibility that we often rely on on people for. But if it could do those things, then great. So it really just comes down to the work you guys are doing. You know, are the tools adequate to the practical tasks of the real world? You know, which can be complex or involve a lot of interfacing with real variables. They're often not simple. But if it can do those, then as a patient, then great.
Yeah. So there are different angles to your question, and I would just start by saying, I think we are talking about the next generation and not this current generation, who is very much conditioned to talk to a tool rather than a human being. Have you ever tried to call your friend and they respond? My four kids respond back to my phone calls by saying, okay, mom, I'll text you in a minute. And they hung up. They never pick up the phone. They want to talk to a screen. And so we are developing these tools with that generation in mind, not this generation who prefers to have a human being on the other end. And as we use these tools, if you compare these AI chatbots now versus 6 months ago, you will find out that they're much smarter right now. In certain companies, they are doing amazing. Insurance, you will never get a real person in the near future. They have ingested every single clause in the insurance books, and chatbots will be much more efficient to give you an answer than a real human being on the other end. And so once we get to a point where we are getting immediate response that is satisfactory, we will not care whether it's a real human or a chatbot. You will not even distinguish the voice. The developments that have taken place in the last 6 months are worth 20 years in other fields. And it's only going to get bigger. The technology that they're using and we will be using in AI are going to be cutting edge, that we don't care if it's taking away the human on the other end.
Yeah, and it becomes like a Turing test. It's like, is this chatbot, you know, smart, funny, understands me emotionally, writes like Hemingway? Yeah. Maybe not. But what is the person you would have talked to that way?
Right.
I mean, it's like that's a high bar, and if ultimately it can do the job as well or better. Now, you might still say, I occasionally need that exceptional person, and if we've like removed them all from the system, then there's no way to, you know, escalate things. But hopefully you end up with a more robust system than that.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
I guess on the kind of emotional level, I'm curious what you would say, because I think a lot of people listening, both with regards to medicine and just the world we live in general, we're all a little afraid of change. And in the modern world, change is coming increasingly fast. That's just how technology is working. And I think a lot of people would say that nowhere has this become as apparent as AI, because it seems like the progress has been so fast and in many ways so confusing and opaque to the average person that it is just a little scary. So, I mean, what would you say to people who just find all of this to be just fundamentally kind of frightening? And I don't know how much that differs from the weaver who was scared about the idea of looms or whatever. Maybe there is a lot that is in common there. I'd like to think there is some qualitative differences because of the pace and because of the novelty of the technology itself, but I'm sure there is some of that too. But as someone who is kind of on the other side, who is moving these things along, I mean, what would you say to these people?
So about losing their jobs in the near future or losing their humanity?
I guess from that perspective, from, you know, what it means to your job, sure. If you've spent a long time developing a career which might not exist anymore, perhaps as a patient who might interface with these things, and I guess just with someone who lives in a world that may become very radically different, you know, fairly soon.
So I'll give you an example of something that happened to me a long time ago in my career, where one of my colleagues, analyst, I used to be a supervisor, was holding back on the work that has been done because, and when I asked why, the reason was, if I share it, I will lose my ability to protect my job. And I'm like, no, if you share it, you will be doing better and bigger things. and not continue to do the stuff that you were trained to do. And so it's exactly that. If we think beyond ourselves, we're trying to use the current wave to help ourselves help others in the future. I've learned that anything that you do, if you do it right, it's not going to only be good for you, it's going to be good for everybody else. And so if we let go of the things that the machine can do on our behalf, we don't know our potential. Humans are so smart, and we could potentially be much more savvy and articulate and smart and civilized to forget about the minutiae and the little things that the machine can do, including some smart, cognitively impossible things that we can think of right now, and free our time to do the creative, the handle things that are much more important in life. And maybe it will enable us to spend more time with one another, which we have not been able to do lately. And so I am not worried. I think the future is always going to be mystical and mysterious of what is gonna come. But I can tell you that I think if we leverage the technology right, and we do it in such a way that protects the consumer and not use the data in a way that could take advantage of our vulnerabilities and our shortcomings, I think we will have a bright future for everybody. We will be able to democratize knowledge. We will be able to level the playing field. We will see things that we have not seen before, and enable those who are less fortunate than you and I to take advantage of the wealth and the breadth of the things that we have developed for this humanity.
So the world may be very different soon, but there's no reason to think that's a bad thing, or at least as likely to be better than worse.
My stance. My stance.
And I guess the converse of that is to accept that we also probably can't stop it, right? We've never yet seen technology advances that we just decided to say no to.
Impossible to stop it right now. It's been done. We're just trying to figure out how to use it.
All right, Brian. What else should we talk about?
I don't know. I think that that's a good place to stop. I think this is potentially a very scary thing for a lot of people. But like you said, I think we can't stop it, and potentially it's phenomenal, right? I mean, I get excited thinking about all the little menial tasks that we have to do every day being, even if they're not taken away, just being made easier. Right, and reducing that burden a little bit so that you can focus on bigger things. And I sort of think back in a very non-technical way to, so years ago when I was first starting out in healthcare, I was a patient technician, in the emergency room, so not even a licensed nurse yet. And I remember we had this, I think it was a trauma or something, came in and coded, and, I have like three surgeons there, and they're all kind of fighting over who's going to do chest compressions. And here I am standing there with nothing to do. And I can't get to because they're all these doctors are working on this patient. And finally the charge nurse was like, everybody back away and let Brian get in there to do chest compressions. It's literally all he can do at this point. And my first thought was, thanks. But I sort of took away from that when you're looking at how to delegate tasks, the best thing to do is focus on the things that only you can do, right? So if I'm running a code, I'm the only one that can intubate in the room. I'm the only one that can put a chest tube in the room. I don't need to be doing chest compressions because there's 10 other people that can do that. I don't need to be running out to get supplies. There's people that can do that. And so I think about that in this way, right? That if we can take a task off my plate that a computer can do or a machine can do, freeing me up to be able to do the things that only I can do, whether I'm a physician or a nurse practitioner or a PA or a nurse or a respiratory therapist or even a patient care tech, then I think it can't help but make everything better.
I think so. And to just add to that is So AI, well, the future for AI is AGI or AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, which is not subspecialized. It's going to do lots of other things. It's going to plan for you. It's going to plan your life, basically. And so this analogy that you have given might work, but the thing that you do best may not be as you described. The thing that you may do best is something that you can do for yourself. I think we have a huge responsibility to protect the humanity on this earth at this point, because there are going to be lots of lost jobs if we let the AI take over. But we have a responsibility to ensure that we kind of balance what we can use AI for and what not. We can easily, with AGI, we can easily eliminate lots of jobs. Lots of jobs. I mean, some organizations are letting go thousands I am not going to mention any particular one, but in healthcare, there are organizations that let go of people just in the thousands. And when I questioned why, I think AI has something to do with that. But, you know, so what happened to these people? We have to be really careful and responsible in how we run this this world all together, and ensure that we don't create a chaotic situation where lots of people are losing their jobs because this new kid on the block called AI. So lots of responsibility. Bottom line should not always be the motive for decisions that we make, especially in healthcare. There's going to be the aspect of, you know, the human sanctity and respect the human in each one of us.
Probably wrap it up there. I'll leave you all with the line from, I think it was Douglas Adams, that any new technology that is invented before you're 15 or 20 is just a natural part of the world. And if it comes before you're 30 or 35, then it's exciting and you could probably get a career in it. And anything that happens after you're 40 is unnatural and unholy and is going to destroy the world. And I think that describes something very real about our psychology. And I ultimately, I think, is all those things are true. I mean, new technology is fascinating and also, you know, treacherous and dangerous and ultimately is just part of the new world we're living in. So hopefully we can kind of embrace all those facets at the same time. But I'm really glad you're able to join. This has been just fascinating.
Yeah.
I'll just remind everyone that we're all just talking about our own thoughts here. We're not representing any of our own institutions here. And we'll talk to you next time.